Laura, have you finished your homework?
Almost, Mom.
What are you doing?
Well, making dough balls out of the leftover bread for fishing bait.
That's very frugal of you, Laura. But I think you'll be needing the homework before you need the bait.
Little House on the Prairie, the book series and then the 1970s TV show, define the character of Midwestern life for people around the world. It's the iconic story of a pioneer family settling in Minnesota and then Kansas in a covered wagon. And today's do-it-yourselfers have got nothing on the Ingalls crew.
Just have to take a chance sometimes, don't you, Pa?
That's part of being alive.
Like we did when we came across the prairie?
Yeah. Sure, a lot of people didn't know what they're going to run into, so they're afraid to take a chance.
But you weren't afraid, and everything worked out all right, didn't it, Pa?
That it did.
But what if it hadn't?
Well, you just take a deep breath and start over.
But mostly it turns out all right, doesn't it, Pa?
Yeah, mostly. If you have faith and you work hard. Speaking of work, I better get going.
Laura Ingalls Wilder, who wrote the Little House books based on her own life experience, died more than 60 years ago. But her autobiography, which had been languishing in archives, was just published. The small publishing house behind the project printed 15,000 copies. That's a lot for an academic book. They sold out almost immediately. Not only that, but the second printing run has also sold out. Amazon orders won't be filled until the third printing, scheduled for March. I'm Gina Kaufman, the editor of Pioneer Girl, is with us on Central Standard to talk about the life of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Pamela Smith-Hill, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for being with us. Have you been surprised by the enthusiasm around this publication?
I have been overwhelmingly surprised by the response to Pioneer Girl. I always knew that Laura Ingalls Wilder was popular, that fans around the world found her endearing and they treasured her books. But what I didn't realize is that Laura Ingalls Wilder is actually a rock star, and she's a global rock star, and she speaks to millions of people across generations, cultures, and continents.
Why do you think that is? Have you figured it out, or are you still wrestling with that one yourself?
I've come to the conclusion that, at least in my opinion, and I'm sure your listeners will have their own views on this subject, that Laura Ingalls Wilder resonates with so many readers for primarily two reasons. First, there's that fictional character of Laura Ingalls herself. She's fierce, she's courageous, she's smart, she's resourceful, but she's also flawed in a very believable way. She has a hot temper.
Yeah,
she can hold a grudge.
And that's kind of different from the TV show, it seems like. She's a little bit more squeaky clean in the TV show.
Oh, yes, yes. The Laura Ingalls from the television series is a bit more soft and sentimental. The Laura Ingalls in the books is a tougher character. And I think that's why, although there are fans who really cling to the TV series versus the books, and then there are fans who love them both, I do think that the Laura Ingalls from the books is the more heroic character.
So we'll get back to that, but you mentioned two reasons, and I'm curious about the other reason why you think people are so obsessed with Laura Ingalls Wilder.
The second reason I think that Laura Ingalls Wilder has remained so timeless, this relates back to the books, not to the television series, but readers of the Little House books are drawn into Laura's story and her character through the voice of the narrative. Laura Ingalls Wilder has this very simple, direct, yet eloquent and lyrical narrative voice that pulls readers into the story. And yet there's enough spaces between and around and underneath the words so that readers can project their own ideas and images and feelings into the text. I think that's the second reason why Wilder's reputation remains so enduring.
She really is an excellent storyteller. I had not reread any of these Little House books until last night, and I did some rereading, and the way she sets up a dramatic scene that's about to happen without your even realizing that you're being set up is really very clever.
I agree. I think that Laura Ingalls Wilder was a natural storyteller. Perhaps she inherited that trait from her father, Charles Ingalls, who, according to Wilder herself, was a very, very vivid storyteller. And in fact, his stories prompted Wilder in many ways to write both the autobiography and the Little House book series.
So in looking into this a little bit, just trying to understand myself what's going on with these books flying off the shelf, these autobiographies of Laura Ingalls Wilder, I noticed there's a yearly event called Laura Palooza, which takes place in South Dakota. I mean, there is a fandom that exceeds what I had ever imagined. Have you ever been to Laura Palooza?
Yes, Laura Palooza will be moving to South Dakota actually for, I believe it's the first time this summer.
Oh.
I attended, I believe it was the first Laura Palooza, and it was in Minnesota. And Laura Palooza is a really interesting mix. There are lots of fans who attend Laura Palooza. There are scholars and historians who present serious papers. But there are also what I would call amateur Wilder scholars who present very insightful and interesting academic work in their own right. It's a very interesting and dynamic mix. So
what,
for people who are interested in...
I need to jump in for a second because I'm curious about the amateur Laura Ingalls Wilder scholars and the insights that they have introduced you to. For example.
Well, one of the papers that was read during the first Laura Palooza that I attended was given by a meteorologist. She was not a traditional Wilder scholar at that time, but she presented a paper that actually traced weather patterns during the hard winter that Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote about in her novel, The Long Winter. It was really fascinating, and it was very serious academic work.
So, what else did you discover at Laura Palooza?
Well, I found that, again, the Wilder fans are really passionate. And they think about Laura Ingalls Wilder as not a writer necessarily of historical fiction, although that's what she really did. But they think about Laura Ingalls Wilder as a writer who is relevant and current in their own lives, and who continues to influence what they think, what they read, and how they talk about books and literature.
Do you think it influences how they talk about the Midwest? Because I have the sense that Little House on the Prairie has taught a lot of little kids what it means to be from this part of the country and given them a sense of geographic roots, but that's an informal observation on my part.
Certainly, the response to Pioneer Girl has been almost global. The book has been reviewed in the UK, in France, in Asia, in Switzerland, and then all across the United States. But I will say that the kind of heartland of response to Wilder's new book has been from the Midwest. And I think it's because Wilder's heart is there. Her family moved from Wisconsin to Kansas, back to Wisconsin, to Minnesota, and then on to Dakota Territory. So her childhood and adolescence took shape in the Midwest. And I think the values that she talks about still resonate with people there today.
If someone who had never met a Midwesterner stumbled upon a pile of Little House books and read them all cover to cover, what do you think this person would think Midwesterners are like, just based on the characters in these books?
The characters in Wilder's books face hardship with courage and optimism. They have strong commitments to their family. They also have strong commitments to the earth. They live from the land. They live close to the land, and they respect it. There's also a strong commitment to friendships, neighbors, and to faith.
One thing that kind of struck me in just the little bit of reading I did last night was that there are several scenes in a very short span of time where Laura is stifling her emotions and expressing that she views this as a really noble thing to do. Like she complains and her mom stops her, and then she recognizes that she's being very naughty inside by continuing to think complainy thoughts. And she's going to cry because she believes her dog is dead, but she doesn't, because that wouldn't be okay. So she just swallows it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This kind of emotional, this kind of emotional restraint actually was a served as an argument between Laura Ingalls Wilder and her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, who was a well-known literary figure in the 1920s and 30s and was a much more popular writer than Laura Ingalls Wilder was when Wilder began to write the books. And Rose Wilder Lane felt that Wilder's characters in the Little House books were too restrained, that they didn't show enough emotion. And Laura Ingalls Wilder argued against that. She said that her family never made a large show of emotion. They were not terribly sentimental. They felt it was better to hold their emotions back, even though they felt emotions very deeply.
So it sounds like her daughter was making a human or a literary argument, and Laura Ingalls Wilder was making kind of a historic accuracy and faithful recounting kind of argument.
Laura Ingalls Wilder felt a great deal of commitment to history. She certainly changed the facts of her life, and she changed some elements in history to tell a better story. But in terms of the big picture, she really wanted to present a historical view of her childhood and adolescence. She was really committed to doing that. As for her persistence and her tenacity to make sure that her characters weren't overly sentimental or overly emotional, I think that, too, turned out to be a very wise literary decision, because it allows the readers to see or feel the emotion rather than to hear about it. Rose Wilder Lane's approach was to tell readers how to feel as they read the books, and Wilder's was to pull readers into the characters' emotions and let readers experience their characters' emotions simultaneously with the character. I know that sounds kind of abstract, but it's a more effective way to deal with emotion in fiction.
Well, and there's that tension between what's going on visibly and what's going on inside a character's mind.
Exactly. And, of course, the more tension you have in a story, the better it is.
If you remember reading the Little House books, what stuck with you? Are there scenes you think about to this day? Tell us what you want to know from the woman who wrote those scenes. About the woman who wrote those scenes, excuse me, 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. That's 816-235-2888. When I think about Laura Ingalls Wilder, I think about today's DIY or do-it-yourself movement. I have a friend who's sort of like a young, single, hip, artsy woman who taught herself to churn butter using the Little House books as source material. Do you think we can romanticize the days when people did all these things for themselves, maybe forgetting that they didn't have a choice? Or is there something important about today's desire to regain some of these skills?
Well, first I want to mention and recommend a book to your listeners, Wendy McClure's The Wilder Life, which kind of takes on this topic, what it would be like to try to live that wilder life in the 21st century. So if your readers are interested in that, I highly recommend the book. It's quite good.
What's the name of that book again?
The Wilder Life by Wendy McClure.
Okay, yeah.
I think it is sometimes easy to romanticize the past, but I also think Wilder's books serve us well so that we can remember how life was like for pioneers and the sacrifices and hardships they had to make. And in some small measure, those can inspire us to think in new ways about the lives we're living now. I think that's very important.
I'm going to come clean about something mostly for our listeners' sake, because I'm pretty sure you already know this. I could not get my hands on a copy of your book, this autobiography of Laura Ingalls Wilder with your annotations. Believe me, we tried. There are no exceptions to this book shortage, and that includes press.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. But so I just want to come clean that I'm learning about the contents of this book right alongside our listeners. Okay, Pamela?
Right, right. And I have to say that members of my own family have still not gotten the copies that they ordered to give as Christmas gifts yet. So the shortage extends to my family and friends. It is a hard book to get your hands on.
It's like the Cabbage Patch Kids back in the 80s. Well, let's get back to the book itself. What inspired you to try and get Laura Ingalls Wilder's autobiography published so long after it was written?
Well, the story of the autobiography, this annotated edition, actually dates back to my work on my first book on Laura Ingalls Wilder. In 2005, I was commissioned to write a biography on Laura Ingalls Wilder by the South Dakota State Historical Society Press. And I began to do research on the book almost right away. In 2006, I spent several days at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library, which has a large collection of Rose Wilder Lane's papers as well as Wilder's papers. And I was sitting in the archive room. It's a very small library. It's very intimate and cozy. And an archivist was sitting across the room from me, and I heard him field a telephone call. And it was clear that he was talking about Pioneer Girl. He was talking about the autobiography. The Hoover has several edited versions of Pioneer Girl in their collection. And the archivist was explaining that he could send Xerox copies and how much a Xerox copy would cost, et cetera. And so when he hung up, I looked across the room at him and I said, was that another Wilder scholar? And he said, no. He said it was another reader. He said, we field dozens of calls like this every year from fans who want their own copy of Pioneer Girl. So I kind of filed that thought away. I quoted extensively from Wilder's original rough draft in my book, Laura Ingalls Wilder, A Writer's Life. And then I began to hear from readers who wanted to get their copy of Pioneer Girl. How could they get the original rough draft version? And so all of those elements kind of came together for me. And in the summer, I believe, of 2009, I got in touch with my editor and said, what do you think about this idea? And then the story of Pioneer Girl took off from there.
Why do you think it took so long for this manuscript to make its way into the world? I mean, clearly there's a pretty big demand for it.
Laura Ingalls Wilder finished Pioneer Girl in May 1930. We know precisely when she finished it because her daughter Rose recorded the date in her diary. And over the summer of 1930, the two women worked together to edit and market Pioneer Girl to primarily national magazine editors. In the 1930s, traditionally, an author would try to market both a long-form nonfiction or fiction narrative first to a magazine, and the magazine would publish it in serial form, magazines like the Ladies' Home Journal or the Saturday Evening Post. If the magazine edition had gone well, then an author could in turn sell the manuscript again to a book publisher. This is exactly what Wilder and Lane hoped to do with Pioneer Girl in 1930. However, as your listeners probably can guess, 1930 wasn't an especially good year for a writer to break into this kind of business because of the Great Depression. Magazines like the Saturday Evening Post had already purchased a big inventory of stories when the financial outlook for the magazine was rosier, so they had a huge backlog already. And although Pioneer Girl had a near miss with the Saturday Evening Post, it never found a home in 1930, and by 1933, Wilder abandoned any attempts to publish it on its own. However, a juvenile version of Pioneer Girl sold to a children's book publisher, and that became Little House in the Big Woods. But that's another story.
It is another story, and we'll get to that one. Central Standard is going to take a short break. We'll get back into the life and times of Laura Ingalls Wilder when we return. Call 816-235-2888 with your Little House memories. We'll get right to those calls when we come back. We're back. Today's show is all about Laura Ingalls Wilder and the Little House books and the many people alive today whose ideas about themselves and maybe even their region come from the Little House books. Do you read them differently as an adult than you did as a kid? Did they shape how you think about the Midwest? Call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, and our guest this morning is Pamela Smith-Hill, who edited Laura's recently published autobiography, Pioneer Girl. Hi again, Pamela.
Hello.
Right before we went to break, you were telling us the story of the publication of Little House in the Big Woods, the first of the Little House books, after she couldn't break into publishing her own memoir on which that was based.
Right. I should point out that Pioneer Girl was originally written for adult readers. Obviously, if you're targeting the Saturday Evening Post or Ladies Home Journal, you're not writing for children. However, during the summer of 1930, a juvenile version of Pioneer Girl emerged, and it caught the attention of a children's book editor at Alfred Knopf. She felt that this version, which was, I should point out, also fictionalized, would have a life as a children's book. So she got back in touch first with Rose Wilder Lane and then with Laura Ingalls Wilder, asking for revisions to this juvenile version of Pioneer Girl. And it went on to become Little House in the Big Woods, the first book in Wilder's Little House series. I should point out that although the adult version of Pioneer Girl never found publication during Wilder's lifetime, she used it as an outline for the rest of her Little House series. And her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, also mined material in Pioneer Girl to write two frontier novels, Let the Hurricane Roar, which has since been retitled Young Pioneers, and Free Land. Both of those books were also published in the 1930s.
Let's hear from some of our listeners. We've got Bethany in Westwood, Kansas on the line. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, good morning.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I've been listening very intently. It's a great conversation. So I called in because I got my first set of Little House on the Prairie books in 1984 when my parents gave them to me when I was just learning to read, and I've been reading them ever since. And I really was struck by what your guest was saying about the role of just the portrayal of emotions, and I've always been struck by the portrayal of different stages of life, how Laura Ingalls Wilder captured that. She really is able to present the voice of a six-year-old girl in, you know, Little House on the Prairie all the way up to an adult, and that's been very interesting for me as I've read them from childhood to adulthood. Different elements of that presentation have really resonated with me. I remember in high school having a run-in with a teacher, and I came home and I was feeling really horrible, and I read the story of Laura having her run-in with her teacher, Eliza Wilder. I think it's in Little Town on the Prairie, and I'm feeling comforted by that, just realizing that that is something that happens when you're in that stage of life. And I've been struck by that element of her.
Well, thanks so much,
Bethany.
Of
life.
Yeah, just of the process of growing up, no matter where you're doing it. Pamela, what do you hear there?
I think that's a really good point. And it builds off my earlier point about the voice, the narrative voice in the Little House books, because your listener made a great point. When Little House in the Big Woods opens, Laura is a little girl. She's 5 or 6 years old. And the voice sounds so believable and credible for a 5 or 6 year old. By the time the series ends, Laura is 18 and she's just married Almanzo. The narrative voice that takes readers through that whole story is, on the one hand, consistent. You always know as a reader that it's still Laura's voice, but it matures throughout the series, and it matures in a believable and credible way. And I think this is another great artistic attribute of the books.
So the readers can grow up with Laura, which kind of reminds me of something people say about the Harry Potter books.
Yes.
Which then, if you think about the scale of the phenomenon, are these comparable?
Yes. In fact, when I have taught classes on Laura Ingalls Wilder, I discuss the Harry Potter series in relationship to the Wilder books because the characters age and mature in a believable and credible way. So I think, yes, you can make a comparison between the two main characters, the authors in their series.
Thinking about the narrative voice, her descriptions of the Kansas landscape felt really vivid for me. As I read that last night, just the descriptions of the prairie seemed gorgeous and accurate, but, you know, simplified for young readers. Nonetheless, amazing descriptions.
Rose Wilder Lane once told her mother, and I'm paraphrasing here, that no one can describe a landscape better than she can. Laura Ingalls Wilder's description of the prairies are beautiful and moving and gripping, and there are passages in Pioneer Girl, rough draft passages. Wilder wrote the rough draft on tablet paper with lead pencils, and you can still see the lyricism, beauty, and poetry of her descriptions of the natural world. That comes through even in a rough draft, even long before Wilder really grew artistically as a novelist. Readers will see that same kind of voice, that same kind of descriptive power in Pioneer Girl.
When she's in the covered wagon and looks out and sees Kansas for the first time, she describes it as a circle that goes on forever with their wagon always in the middle. And she's referring to the horizon line, which goes on for so long that it actually, you know, kind of at times shows the subtle curvature of the earth. It's something that you take for granted maybe if you live in this part of the country, but it's a really beautiful first encounter, and it actually reminds me a bit of an opening passage in My Antonia by Willa Cather, which is seen as this, you know, very right. literary work, not a children's book.
Well, I do believe that in part because Wilder wrote for children, not adults, her literary reputation has suffered somewhat. And I also feel that because there's this perception that Wilder was simply writing down the facts of her life, that also diminishes her literary merit. But I think it's very astute of you to make a comparison between Laura Ingalls Wilder and Willa Cather, because I think those two women describe what is known as the middle border or the Midwest as no other writers can.
Let's talk to Charles in Kansas City. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. What do you want to add to our conversation?
You know, my wife and I, we've watched the program over and over again, but, you know, we never read the book, you know, that Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote. But I do want to say that my wife really liked, you know, this program, whether the program was an actual, you know, interpretation of the book. I'm sure it wasn't exactly. But, you know, my wife is from Mexico, and she watched Little House on the Prairie in Mexico. And then she came here, and then she saw it in reruns, and she was really, really happy about it. And the thing that impressed her the most is that, you know, family is what matters, you know, because my wife, you know, it touched my wife. Many of the programs that was on, you know, the stories touched and moved my wife. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and just that's a part of that global audience you were talking about, Pamela.
Yes, and the television series, which is still in syndication, won several Emmy Awards. I think the TV Guide named one of its episodes as the 10 greatest of all time several years ago. So there's a really strong fan base for the television series. It is, however, a highly reimagined interpretation of Wilder's original books. But both the television series and the books do focus on family, and that indeed is consistent between the two.
Let's talk with Kathleen in Midtown. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi there. Do you know, you have spoken about how this touches little girls when they can grow up with it. I have a 7-year-old grandson who's very interested in how the United States developed. I have told him stories that my grandmother told me when I was a little girl, and she was on the plains, and she did have experiences with Indians and things like that. And I am not into Harry Potter. Is there anything that a young boy can grow up with in a comparable series?
Let's hear from Pamela on that. Pamela, first of all, do you think that this is a book specifically for young girls, or is this something that a boy should be able to relate to easily?
I think that's a good question. I'm going to answer your question in a couple of different ways. First, I remember when I was a kid, I grew up in Springfield, Missouri, and my teachers didn't read from the Little House books. Instead, they read from the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. And the boys all groaned when my sixth grade teacher announced that she was going to read a Nancy Drew mystery. And they didn't want to listen. And by the end of the first period, after she had read just a few pages of the first Nancy Drew book, the boys were transfixed. And they were as enthusiastic about Nancy Drew by the end of the book as the girls were. So that said, certainly the Little House books tend to appeal more to girls. However, I have come across many men and several boys who have picked up the books and found something fascinating and something gripping and memorable and relevant in those books. Wilder herself tended to view her Little House series as books for girls as well, although, of course, Farmer Boy was her one book for boys. And there is a letter that she sent to Rose Wilder Lane back in the 1930s. Laura Ingalls Wilder had received a fan letter from a boy about Little House on the Prairie, and she was so thrilled that a boy had been excited about the book and wanted more. So I do think that boys can read the Laura Ingalls Wilder series and take something away from it. However, you know, traditionally boys like to read about boy main characters. And so I would suggest that you look into, talk to your librarians about books for boys, contemporary historical novels for boys. It's harder to find historicals that are written for girls or boys right now because children's publishing is much more focused on fantasy and dystopian worlds. It's
interesting.
Hard to get good historicals. But one classic boys book does pop into my head. It's called Rifles for Wadey, and it was published in the 1950s, and it is set in Missouri and Arkansas during the American Civil War. And since you're in Kansas City, some of your readers might find that book to be really interesting. It was also a Newbery Award-winning book back in the 1950s.
Let's hear from Gary in Westport. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I just wanted to chime in and say I'm one of those guys that loved the Little House books. I was a voracious reader as a young boy, and my sister had been given the series as a set when she was a little girl. And being a reader, I just finally one day just got to looking at them and being, you know, always being attracted to history, I started reading them and just became really fascinated and just read them pretty quickly. And still really enjoy the images and the spirit that I read in that still stays with me to this day.
Is there a moment
that
really like resonates and that you recall with some regularity?
Oh, just I think the overall images that the whole series gave really stayed with me. You know, the simplicity of life, and I thought. And as I've learned more about history in that time period, I just found it really valuable source, you know, for the way people lived and their lives and the simplicity and then the motion of people, you know, moving across the landscape and then having her end up in the Ozarks of all places.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Gary.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Well, okay. I wanted to say I lived about 15 minutes away from her adult home in Mansfield and got to visit it several times. And
well, very cool.
Wonderful museum there about her. So.
Thanks. I agree. I grew up about 40 miles from Rocky Ridge Farm in Mansfield, Missouri, where Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote Pioneer Girl and all of her Little House books. And I think a lot of people assume that Laura Ingalls Wilder lived and wrote in Minnesota or the Dakotas, and they're surprised that she lived out most of her life in the Missouri Ozarks. That surprises a lot of people who don't know a great deal about Wilder's actual life.
You know, our caller just mentioned the scenes where the family is traveling across the landscape, and there are some really frightening scenes, especially, you know, like they have to travel in the winter so that they can get over the ice of the Mississippi River before it unfreezes, and they travel across it, and then in the night, just as they're setting up camp on the other side, they hear the ice cracking. You know, it's terrifying. There are terrifying scenes in this book.
Yes. And, you know, people tend to think, as your caller mentioned, that the Ingalls family lived a simple life. I'm not so sure I would agree with a simple life in that sense, because think of how hard they had to work just to put supper on the table. They worked very, very hard. I can't really say that life was simple. It may seem that their social interactions were more simple than ours, but the fact that they had to produce everything they ate, everything they wore, almost everything they wore and ate from the land itself or with their own hands, that occupied a great deal of their time. And so even their life in Kansas was not especially simple. They were living in Kansas illegally on Indian lands, and there was a great deal of unrest on the Osage Diminished Reserve at the time. Their lives itself, their lives themselves were in danger, and so they lived a life that may on the surface to us seem simple, but I think we would have a hard time living that life today.
What is the main difference, would you say, between the story that Laura wrote for herself or for an adult readership and the Little House books based on that adult narrative? Are there scenes she doesn't include in the kids' books because of their mature content?
This has come up many times. The Pioneer Girl autobiography is certainly grittier and edgier. It includes whole sections of Wilder's life that she chose not to write about in the Little House series, not necessarily because the material was too adult. I want to talk about that in a minute. But because, as she wrote her daughter, it didn't fit into the picture of the fictional family she was trying to make. So at one point in the family's history, the Ingalls family moved east instead of west. This was after the grasshopper plague had struck in Minnesota. The Ingalls family had pretty much hit rock bottom financially. The grasshoppers had wiped them out. They moved east to Burr Oak, Iowa, where the Ingalls family briefly ran a hotel, and that didn't work out. Along the way, the Ingalls' son, Freddie, who was only 9 months old, died on that trip east. So there are whole elements of Wilder's life that she did not include in the Little House books, but primarily for thematic reasons, which we might be able to talk about later.
Central Standard is headed to one more break. Pamela Smith-Hill, stay with me for just a minute.
Will do.
More on Laura Ingalls Wilder's Kansas when we come back. Then we'll hear what you want to ask your legislators during our Tell KCUR segment. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to Central Standard. You still have just a minute to get in on this conversation about Laura Ingalls Wilder. We'll try to get to all of our calls before we go, though that might be a tall order. Our guest is Pamela Smith-Hill, who wrote a biography of Laura Ingalls Wilder and who recently edited the famous Pioneer's autobiography, which sold out almost as soon as it hit the shelves. Hi again, Pamela.
Hello.
So I want to get back to what you were saying right before the break about the things that she didn't include in the children's stories and why. And you've said that it wasn't because of adult content.
Right. I think one of the things that we forget about now in the 21st century is that children's literature in the 1930s and 1940s was a very different proposition than it is today. Writers really weren't allowed to talk about some of the darker, grittier subjects, sex, divorce, child abuse, those themes that now are part of children's literature and are very much accepted. And actually, Laura Ingalls Wilder was pushing the envelope with her Little House books, including scenes like Mrs. Brewster and the Butcher Knife in These Happy Golden Years. That was a very daring and edgy scene in the early 1940s when that book was published. Even including Mary's Blindness was a new and novel and darker element in children's literature in the late 1930s. And in fact, Rose Wilder Lane, Wilder's daughter, discouraged her mother from including Mary's Blindness in the ongoing series.
I want to talk to you about Mary's Blindness, actually, because Mary is Laura's sister. And you consulted a lot of people to get a modern understanding of the stories Laura tells in the Little House books. And one of those stories is Mary's Blindness. You consulted, I hear, medical experts to try and figure out what
actually happened. Actually, a team of medical experts reviewed Mary's case as I was working on the book. And so independently, they issued new findings that revealed a totally different kind of picture for Mary's blindness than what Laura herself provides in the book and in Pioneer Girl. In Pioneer Girl, doctors assume that Mary's blindness was brought on from a very serious bout of German measles followed by a stroke. And in the novels, Mary suffers from scarlet fever. In fact, all the girls suffered from scarlet fever, but much earlier in their lives. And I think scarlet fever was a convenient literary vehicle for Laura Ingalls Wilder, who didn't want to dwell too much on the causes of Mary's blindness in her fiction. She just wanted to move the story forward and not dwell on too much unhappiness. And scarlet fever, of course, is what cost Beth and Little Women her life. So there were literary antecedents, and scarlet fever was indeed a very serious disease, childhood disease in the 19th and early 20th centuries. But I think what's interesting now, although the medical team, contemporary medical team, discounted the German measles diagnosis for Mary's blindness, now that we're involved in a German measles outbreak in the 21st century, I have heard from several sources that measles in its most extreme cases can indeed cause blindness.
Let's hear from Marcia in Overland Park. Hi, Marcia.
Hi, I'm so enjoying this. Thank you for this. But I wanted to say that I was not a reader as a child. I never watched the series on television, but my mother had gotten the series at a library sale of used books and for her grandkids. And so I get a call, and she says, "Have you ever read these?" And I said, "No," thinking they're children's books. And she says, "Oh, my gosh, you have to read these." So I had 2 weeks off at Christmas, and I read all of them.
What did you take away?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I mean, there's so many layers to those books, but one thing that you were talking about, the adult narrative, but I guess because I was in my 50s, I took away that what these parents went through, that this could not have been an easy life, that when Laura would describe something, you know, so beautifully, you know, living on the banks of, I think, I forgot the name of the creek. But
Plum Creek.
Yes. And I thought, this could not have been a very pleasant thing for her parents to live, or I think especially her mom.
Yeah, right. Let's get some response.
In the side of it. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Marcia. Pamela?
I think this is another gift that Wilder brings us. And again, it gets back to that narrative voice that as children, we can read the Little House books and we read on one level. We can come back as adults and see something entirely new and more complex and more nuanced in the books. And in fact, when I teach creative writing classes, I often bring Wilder's books in and have students study them, not just because they're children's literature, but because you can learn from them whether you're writing for adults or for children in terms of the technique and the nuance and the subtlety of Wilder's style. She writes for a whole range of readers.
Speaking, we have just a minute left, and I want to know from you the last thing quickly. Tell us about Laura Ingalls Wilder, the woman after 18, after the Little House books have ended.
Well, Laura Ingalls Wilder and her husband, Almanzo, had a very difficult time during the first few years of their marriage. In 1894, they moved to the Missouri Ozarks, and they spent the rest of their lives there. In 1911, Laura Ingalls Wilder began working as a newspaper columnist for the Missouri Ruralist, and she worked as a columnist and as a page editor until about 1924.
Wow, and so she had
a
career.
And she was a very popular writer at that time. So she cut her teeth professionally in journalism before she launched her career as a memoirist and novelist.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Pamela Smith-Hill, for joining us today. It's been really fun chatting with you.
Yes, I enjoyed it terrifically. Thank you very much.
Pamela Smith-Hill is the editor of Pioneer Girl, the new annotated autobiography of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Why don't you talk to me? Why don't you talk? Now, before we go, it's time for Tell KCUR. Here for that is Laura Ziegler, KCUR's community engagement reporter. Hi, Laura.
Woohoo. Hi, Gina.
What did we ask people this week?
Well, in as much as it's the beginning of the legislative session and a lot of controversial, contentious issues on the horizon, we asked people if they had an opportunity, they would ask or tell their legislator. Lots and lots of responses, which is very exciting.
That is exciting.
What we like. Mm-hmm. Education, health, immigration, budget, taxes, the whole gamut.
It's related to a new podcast we're doing, State House Blend, where reporters and local listeners are going to get to hang out with a different legislator every episode. The idea being that we're going to get to know these people who make huge decisions that shape our laws and our lives. So what did we hear back from folks?
That's right. Medina Saladi of Lawrence, Kansas, said, as a U.S. citizen is living 10,000 miles from her husband because in May of last year he was deported to Bangladesh, I wish my legislators would be compassionate and humane instead of fighting against immigration reform for political reasons. Ellen Murphy from Mission Hills told us, I would tell the Kansas legislature that it does not have my endorsement to open the state to gun makers in order to cover up Governor Brownback's mishandling of our state's school funding. And Sarah McDaniel wants to know, how can we demilitarize our police? I see them out and it looks like we are in a war zone. They're armed to the teeth and I'm more terrified of them than any potential criminal.
I love the passion in these responses. Can we unpack any of this, or is that for a later time?
I think that's for a later time because they're so all over the gamut. I think the takeaway is that people are super engaged in these issues and I hope they all vote. Because that's kind of what we're hoping, that we all want to be informing the electorate. Bill Steffen tweeted, legislators were elected to practice good governance, not their personal religion. So that's kind of interesting. And from Facebook, a number of responses. Abby Blair Beckloff said, I'd ask for those who don't support government funding for arts and culture in their state, what information or data would help make arts and culture something they might support in the future? Jennifer Beyer says, the Kansas 50-year water plan. We are in dire straits. That's something I know we've been hearing about this month on our show, Marketplace. Anne McGregor.
And on Central Standard.
Anne McGregor says Article 3, Section 15 of the Missouri Constitution sets forth the oath that each legislature must take that says, I will not knowingly receive directly or indirectly any money or other valuable thing for the performance of my job.
So, Laura, did we get any calls?
We got three different calls. Actually, we got several different calls. We only have time to play three of them. And the first one was an anonymous woman who was concerned about a number of things. Let's listen.
I would first of all say that I think my legislators probably agree with me, so I'm not talking to them. I'm talking to the Republicans in the state of Missouri. First, expand Medicaid, which we desperately need for all Missouri health care. Leave women's health to women and doctors. I think that's a true issue of freedom.
All right. That's the first woman we heard from. A second woman is an extremely angry woman who had a very strong opinion about money and politics.
Yes, this message is for the congressional whores, both federal and state, who are masquerading as public servants while, in fact, they're setting up their future lucrative lobbying jobs. I'd like to know whatever happened to noblesse oblige, which is the responsibility of privileged people to act with generosity towards less privileged people. This is part of all the world's major religions and was practiced by some Congress people in the past.
So that's noblesse oblige. Wow.
Yep, that's people who are saying, what's happened to the safety net? What's our responsibility? What's the responsibility of government to take care of the less fortunate?
So there's another call you want to play, right,
Laura?
Our
third caller is from a gentleman who also feels strongly about something we heard about before, money and politics.
If I could talk to my legislators, I would discuss three important topics. One, passing common sense gun legislation. I think it's outrageous that after a gunman with an automatic weapon killed 20 children and 6 adults at an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut, that our legislators are so afraid of the NRA that they couldn't even pass a law requiring background checks. Which brings me up to the second point, passing campaign finance reform, limiting the amount of money that individuals and corporations and political bundling organizations can contribute to a campaign. You have to either be a millionaire and spend your own money or find a rich sugar daddy to finance your campaign, and who are you are beholden to after the election. And the third topic to bring up with the legislators is passing non-discrimination laws in housing and employment for gay people. Even with gay marriage in 36 states, there are still 29 states where you can be fired for being gay, and there's no protection at the federal level.
That's all the time we have for today's show. Laura Ziegler, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We're hopefully going to get to ask our legislators a lot of these questions from our listeners. You can listen back to today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, we're going to spice things up. Literally, that is what we are going to do. It's a food show all about spice and heat, starting with a spice challenge at a local restaurant. Don't miss it. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. It's been fun, everyone. Stick around for my pal Steve Kraske and the Ethics Professors coming up next.